Hello, and welcome to a special addendum to Q&A Quest episode 436, because somehow I forgot to talk about impressions from PAX East 2026.
Nice job,
Because of
dipshit.
sports, I'm Mike Apps, and here to help me.
Berate you.
Yes, here to berate me and bounce off my comments because I have a hard time recording into the void. Meaning just talking myself
Void the
is
knot. There's Brownie Family Master.
so yeah, let's jump right into it. Played some interesting games at the show. I jumped right to the Nippon Ichi NIS America booth was my first appointment, and played some Disgaea Mayhem, which if you've played Disgaea and you've played a Musou, you are getting exactly what you expect.
I expect no less.
Just slaughtering lots of printies. But yeah, the demo had three different stages. You could pick from all the classic Disgaea weapon types. And although there's only one character you play as in the game, it uses the whole magic change system where there'll be other characters you interact with who essentially become your weapons, and you can kind of see them when you use some of the special skills.
I guess with
As
the magic change, why
yeah,
not?
some of the special skills will like pause the game, and then you can aim like their area effect. So it was very straightforward, but it was a lot of fun. And looks like it should have a fun localization and some probably other weird Disgaea mechanics, like the system where you have to go and get things voted on and some other upgrade mechanics. It's not going to be as in depth as a regular Disgaea game, but it is exactly what I expected, and I honestly didn't need to play much of the demo to know what it is. And it should be a good time. And then also, the reason why I didn't want to spend too much time with that was because the other demo was Brigandine Abyss, which was a lot to take in.
Why is Brigandine back?
I don't know. I'm very unfamiliar with the original first game, other than its name. The sequel on Switch always looked like too much, and this one was also probably too much, but it was very in depth. Like, the demo started with so many tutorials. Like, here's all the strengths and weaknesses. You have some human or humanoid units who have monsters tied to them, and if that character dies, all their monsters will disappear. It mentions seasons, which just hurt my brain, because this is like
Season
more of a whole kingdom
two
management sim in
and
addition to battles,
season
which always
three.
turned me off to the last Switch game. But one thing I did like about this, and compared to the last one, which kind of had bland-looking battlefields where it's kind of zoomed out on a map and just kind of generically moving units along, this one kind of had more of like what you expect from a strategy RPG. With like you're on an actual battlefield. There's terrain that affects how you move. But it's also still like it's like hexes instead of regular squares, so there's a lot as far as movement and moving units around. There's a lot. It's a lot. There were so many tutorial screens that popped up like constantly throughout the demo, which I understand because it's a very in-depth game, but also I don't know if this game is for me. I don't think it is. I don't really like I like kind of smaller g scale strategy RPGs where I have like a party or at least a s smaller set of characters to work with, and this not even seeing like whatever kingdom management aspects are involved here. There's just a lot to deal with. It's just a very crunchy game, and I know that's a lot of people will enjoy that. And I spent the demo moving all the characters up to enemies as quick as I could to mess around with things, and I failed horribly.
Good job.
Yes. Multiple main characters died, and all their monsters disappeared. I didn't place characters very well, and had some unicorn healers that I sent straight into battle and died promptly. Yeah. Not the kind of game you can brain dead your way through. Not that I was doing that, but I wanted to see how things worked. And that was, I guess, not the way to go about it. It was a lot. It was a lot. Like so many different unit types. These elements are strong against these elements, weak against these elements. I think there was some other strength and weakness system in there that was just so much. But I mean, everything seemed to work well, and I guess once you get the hang of it, it should be a lot better. It's a nice looking game too. So, I don't want to sound too negative about it. It seemed like a good game, but
Not a
it's
you game.
not probably not a me game, and it's really hard to get a good feel for it with like a brief demo. And brief, I mean, like I was spent played this for like half an hour. So it seems pretty good though. After that, while wandering around the show, as often happens, I had a fun interaction with someone who liked my One Piece shirt and then naturally said, "Well, what game do you have to show me?" And thankfully, it was RPG-ish, a game called Crystalmancers, which was vaguely similar to Puzzle Quest, where like you're doing a puzzle game and that's translating to combat, like damaging an enemy. Well, this one is roguelike, but instead of like a match three thing, it's kind of Tetris, but not like Tetris, like the pieces falling down. Like you get your Tetris piece and then you have to kind of fit it onto the field. You don't have to drop it down, so if there's like an empty space like surrounded by other things, you can take the piece and put it there. But what's kind of interesting is like the enemies attack you by moving pieces of the board around and doing other things like that. And also random pieces will just kind of come up and move things up, I guess closer to death if you don't clear lines fast enough. But what was really cool is like in between battles, like some of the upgrades you can get would put special properties on blocks, or you can go to the blacksmith and edit blocks by adding or removing squares. So you can take like I don't know the L sh one of the L-shaped pieces and remove a block so it's just a straight line or things like that. It was a lot of fun. Had some bugs while he was playing, but it was very promising, so I definitely recommend people check that out. Then brief non-RPG territory, I played Bubsy 4D. And it was awesome.
Ooh. Yeah, I need to put that on pre-order. It's going to be $20.
Nice. If you've played Demon Tide, no, that's the sequel. Demon Turf. It's the same developer, has a similar feel, but
I'm impressed that they were able to work on both of those at the same time.
yes. It's very fun to like kind of maneuver around the levels. What I played, there weren't a lot of enemies or anything, but the platforming was very fun. You can kind of like float for a little bit, and it's got some other climbing mechanics and stuff like that. I talked to one of the producers on it, and was like, "It's will be good that this series will no longer just be a punchline and have an actual good game." And he did mention it's got like the classic humor of the old games, which I haven't actually played that much of, so I don't know what that means. But he did say...
I think that's mostly a marketing thing. I think that's something that they've been told to say.
But he did say there's like a toggle where I think you can have Bubsy say less, which is interesting.
Yes, there tends to be... Over the last few Bubsy revivals, there's always been like a thing to determine how much Bubsy talks. The thing is, original Bubsy did not actually talk that much. He talked at the beginning and end of levels because that's what a Sega Genesis and a Super Nintendo could really deal with. He talked more in Bubsy 3D, but that's the least of its problems.
Yeah, I don't think I actually hit any talking in this game, so maybe it was just not included in the demo, or maybe someone had turned it off beforehand. I guess I did skip some of the cutscenes too, but whatever. But what was really cool is there's so he can like roll up into a ball. I think it was called like hairball mode or something. But there were sections where you're like rolling down a pipe, and I'm like, this is better than like some 3D Sonic games. Like, this is really smooth and fun. I'm really excited to see what the whole game looks like, because what I played was really fun. Very impressive.
Demon Turf was very good at the general feel of movement. So I'm not surprised that they carried that into Bobbly.
It's very good. I need to pick up Demon Tides at some point too.
Yeah, I'm waiting for that to hit Switch, basically. Yeah, or Switch 2. Demon Turf was quite good, and it had like an expansion that was also good.
Nice. So yeah, this is a Bubsy game that will get a full recommend.
Yeah. Nightmarish as that may be.
Yes. See, after that I went to a Borderlands 4 presentation. Which was
Borderlands, as they say.
Which was at first fun and then deeply boring.
I'm not surprised.
But the reveal of the new character was cool, and they had the voice actor come out on stage. Next to someone cosplaying the new character, like I think someone that works for Gearbox, like a really detailed cosplay. That was cool. New character looks cool. Some of the guns looked cool. And then they did like a developer podcast, and that was kind of whatever. But that DLC came out the day I was there, I think. So. looked cool. I'm behind in Borderlands 4 because I was waiting for the Switch version that is now delayed indefinitely, and I feel like they had to fix some things in the main game itself for that port to happen. So
we'll it seems like I think they kind of ended up in this like all hands on deck to fix like the other versions after launch, and so like The Switch 2 version kind of fell by the wayside while they tried to fix that.
Yeah, it's understandable. So I'm hoping... I mean, my expectation at this point is that, assuming that does come out, it'll be when they do, like, the Game of the Year version or Ultimate version or whatever they're going to call it that has all the DLC packed in.
Mm-hmm.
Once they've got everything ironed out. That was that. And then finally we have the most indie game of the day, Mad Mojo. And I say that because it was a mashup of like every indie thing you can think of. It was taking cues from things like Inscription with like a kind of meta context to it. So the whole idea is you're playing a playtest of a game. Like a monster catching game. So it starts where you're like, oh, what? Pick your character's name. And you try to pick different names. And it forces you to pick a certain one. And then you have to agree to this weird end user license agreement. And weird things happen there. Typical for this kind of thing. So then you kind of go and like, it's a roguelike deck builder monster catching game. with mechanics similar to Balatro. It's weird, but kind of neat, I guess. And then when you die, you end up in like a Windows 95 style desktop where you have to solve puzzles and kind of try and figure out what the hell is going on with this weirdo game. It seemed very interesting and very promising. But I'm going to need to see more to know how good it was and play with the mechanics, because the mechanics were very confusing because I have no interest in Balatro. But your deck is made up of like cards from the different monsters you collected, and each card will have a different color, so you have to kind of make like different hands, which require it's weird. But I recommend people take a look at it because it could be pretty good when it comes out. But that was kind of all I checked out at PAX East. I did play some student game from some students from Quinnipiac University, which is a school in Connecticut, which was kind of silly, which was kind of neat. It was like the hell's the name of that game where you have to rush around making dishes in a restaurant. But you had to do that. It was a two-player game. You had to do that, but instead of cooking a dish, you're cooking a gun, and then you take what you cook out into the parking lot and fight the other player playing the game. It was fun. But that was about it. Not too much was huge at this year's show. But honestly, Bubsy 4D and Disgaea Mayhem were the highlights for me. And that's pretty much it.
Bubsy Bobcat.
Yes. I think Bubsy's out in May. Disgaea is not coming out till later this year, I think in the fall. But yeah, that's about it. Any questions about any of these weirdo games I played?
Not even a little.
Okay, so then we can wrap this up. Apologies that this got slapped onto this episode, but it was a weird weekend of sports, so I was distracted. All right. That's all. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Cut and run through the ball, and who better than this guy?
Get it into Boozer, back for Sarr, ahead, Boozer, that ball deflected and stolen by Mullins. Caravan, 2 seconds, Mullins tosses it out. Oh! It's good! We're 0.3! UConn goes in front! Utterly impossible!
Okay, hello and welcome to Q&A Quest, episode 436. The day that the sun died. I'm your host, Mike Apps, aka Wheels, with me as always.
The day the earth blew up, David McBurney found my master.
It's a good movie.
The day the music died. Nah, that wasn't. No.
It's a good movie.
That got dark. Yeah. I was just talking about a basketball team.
Rip.
Well, yes. So yes. Okay. So hello from Japan, Michael Baker, Gaichi Minokitari. Hello.
And this is Smoke and Joe Gamer. I thought I was a perpetual guest, but I've just been informed I am now considered a host or co-host or something. So
host at large.
Hooray! but don't forget, I'm still a podcast panelist for RP Gamer. And of course, our buddy Matt
Castle
Playtime calls me Joey PP. So
nice.
I've never heard anyone pronounce his name Playtime.
Yeah, I thought it was Platy, and I looked at it one time, and I'm like, wait a minute! Like, it came up on the Game of the Year podcast for RP Gamer. I'm like, wait, Playtime? I thought he just liked the platypus. I thought it was Platy.
It is. You know. Yeah.
Or I thought it was a reference to a Dragon Quest monster that looks like a duck or something. I don't know. So that's cool. But so sometimes I'm Joey Pee Pee. And man, when I was playing Pokemon Pokapia, I found an item that made my pee pee go up.
You're fine.
Well, if it does,
you're fired.
Yeah.
You should go to a Poke Center if it lasts too long.
Nurse Joy will help
me. Don't encourage this further. Yes. What's new?
Other than depression at losing the last major league team in Connecticut.
I'm sorry, man.
It's okay. Listen, it sucks. It sucks ass. If you go, I'm not going to go into the details. People can go out and read about how we were screwed because there were more, there were higher offers on the table to keep the team in New England, but WNBA people wanted to keep, to move the team to Houston, and that was the only thing that was going to happen. And you may think that I am going to disavow the WNBA forever and tell people never to watch it. I'm going to do the opposite right now and tell people that this is the first like women's league to kind of make it big, and we need to support that, especially after they just won a hard fought CBA negotiation. So, fuck the ownership, but watch the WNBA, support those players. Because if this league really gets big, it could mean a lot for other pro women's sports as well. So, yeah, there you go.
So
by contrast, Seattle might soon have two basketball teams.
Yes, I saw that. Congrats on hopefully righting that wrong from years ago.
Of the Sonics.
Yeah. Because the Sonics leaving was so fucking stupid.
Right. So
will not look 1,000 times box upon the Oklahoma City Thunder, but you know, but yeah, we will potentially soon have both the Storm and the Sonics. So that'll be nice.
That would be nice. Yes.
Yeah. So here in Connecticut, the UConn Husky girls are just amazing basketball players. And I guess that have to move to Houston if they want to join the WNBA team?
They are moving, yeah.
Theoretically, they would have to, like that wouldn't be the only WNBA team they could join, but
yeah,
I mean, there's no longer like an obvious place for them to go.
I mean, I'm pretty sure most WNBA teams have at least one player they used to play for UConn. Like, yeah. The level of players that come out of UConn is ridiculous. And I mean, just look at the current team, which is in the Final Four, undefeated.
Yeah.
After losing their best player to the WNBA last year.
Caitlin Collins?
No, Paige Beckers.
Okay.
Was their best player. I think everyone assumed they would not be as good this year, and they have yet to lose.
Well, I go to my parents' house for dinner not recently, but like the last time I was at their house for dinner on Sunday, they're like, oh, we want to watch the UConn game. I'm like, okay. Well, it's like at halftime, they're up like 30 points.
Yeah.
I'm like, why are we, like, this is entertaining and they're good players, but like, I kind of feel bad for the other team. You know,
that's kind of how this year has gone. Like, yeah. This year's team is ridiculous, and most of the players are still going to be there next year.
Oh, so it's all we have in our state. We don't have teams. This is all we have.
actually a lot of good college sports in Connecticut. But yeah, this is that was. Fun fact, the Connecticut Sun were the first WNBA team to turn a profit.
Wow.
So, but yeah, like I said, I'm not going to come out here and tell anyone not to watch it. I have already followed the Instagram account for the New York Liberty, who I will be following after this year. I've gotten a lot more into basketball this recently. It's a great sport, and honestly, the WNBA with a shorter, more focused season is more entertaining than the NBA. Honestly, I can't watch the NBA except for the playoffs.
There's a fucking storm like mural that I pass by every so often when I'm walking downtown.
Nice.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, I highly recommend people check it out. Not for the owners, for the players. Again, can't
a lot of talented emphasize athletes, it. Though.
Yes.
I'm going to be real with you. You don't have a lot of good options for sports if you need the owners to not suck shit.
It's true. It is very true. There are very few good owners out there, unfortunately.
And they will inevitably face teams with bad owners who will also be turning a profit.
Yeah. And if you are in a market that is not large, you should fear for your team's existence constantly. It's just,
yeah,
you should.
I've watched my friend in Oakland who has watched all of his teams get transferred to Vegas.
That one was particularly painful because I remember
that was vampiric. That was a nightmare.
Yeah, I remember the mayor of Vegas was the site for their new stadium was not viable and was saying that Oakland should work it out with the team. Which did not happen, obviously, and they are currently they can't even call themselves the Oakland A's while they're waiting for their stadium to be built. they're just the Athletics.
You know, the Athletics, where are you from? Parts unknown.
Yeah. So where do they even play? Sacramento or some? I don't even know.
Yeah, who can say? Mysterious.
Yeah.
Luckily, I now live in a major market.
Yes, a major market that should be noted. Did, like you said, did still manage to lose a team.
Yeah, it just happens sometimes. It will feel arbitrary and nonsensical, and it will involve some sort of backroom deal that you will read about 10 years later and be like, God damn it, that's fucking stupid.
Yeah, that whole thing was so stupid. You want a team in Oklahoma City? Just fucking expand.
Yeah,
what's
you can just
stopping
do an expansion.
You?
We're watching you do an expansion right now. That is why we're getting the Sonics back, because you are expanding into Seattle again and Vegas.
Well, at least they're expanding into Vegas instead of Vegas stealing someone else's team.
Yeah, I think at least half of Vegas's teams ended up being just stolen from Oakland.
Yeah. Surprisingly, their NHL team, not stolen, just expanded there and promptly won.
Yeah, you know, like a normal thing.
Yeah, and promptly won the Stanley Cup, by the way.
It's Stanley Cup.
Hold on, I know this was a long time ago, but what happened to the Hartford Whalers?
Essentially, they got a deal to get a stadium in Carolina. I forget exactly what city, in probably Raleigh. And our governor at the time, I think, was trying to woo the Patriots to come to Connecticut.
Wow, that was a bad play.
Yes. Apparently the Patriots only gave this any attention because it helped them get a stadium deal in
sure it would bring they pretended to give a shit
wherever
that would allow them to have more leverage.
Whatever hell state town their stadium is in now, it's not actually in Boston, in case anyone's not familiar with any of this. I forget the name of the town. I don't know. I don't recall any of the details other than that, but that is kind of the crux of it.
Okay.
We are legally a sports podcast now.
Yes. Fun facts. Sports fans are nerds.
Yeah. Fun fact. Sports are just full of stats, especially baseball, but all of them.
Baseball is the nerdiest sport. Anyone who tells you otherwise is lying.
All I can say is I recently just seen a thing where it was Munetaka Murakami. He's playing where now? You know?
No.
I want to say Red Sox.
What's his name?
Munetaka Murakami. He's a new guy from Japan to America.
He appears to be on the White Sox.
Ooh.
Okay. Yay. Hooray for him.
No.
That's a rough place to be.
It's a rough place to be, but I'm still cheering him on because I had him for 11th and 12th grade English.
Oh, my God.
No, that's fine.
Yes. Okay, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I hope he ends up on a better team or the White Sox further escape from their historically bad season 2 years ago where they broke the record for most losses.
The news article I saw him on was like second or third home run remark.
Oh, good. Good, good.
Yeah.
The rough thing about baseball is that being a magnificent player will not win you champions if the rest of your team sucks shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fireminer's asking if Ohtani is still big in Japan. I'm going to assume that's a big yes.
Massively.
And considering how huge he is here.
Like, he gets a puppy and it's headlines for like a week.
Wow.
I'd like that.
Elementary schoolers who otherwise know very little about actual baseball know the name of his dog.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
They should start throwing statues of Colonel Sanders into the river again.
No, they specifically chained those statues to the wall to avoid that from happening.
Yeah, that would make it more impressive when you throw them in the river again.
All right, we should probably move on to video games, I guess. Yes. I'm just going to close out the sports.
MLB the Show.
Need to get this year's version, which is not on Switch 2 for some reason. What the fuck?
Because Sony absolutely does not want to put it there. And for now, they have the excuse not to.
Which game?
MLB The Show.
MLB The Show. Because Sony is the only developer that makes an official MLB game at this point. And a few years ago, the MLB basically told them, put it on other consoles or we're going to find someone else to let have the license.
And so they did.
And so they did, but they weren't happy about it.
No. And the first year, it was on everything. It was on Game Pass.
What's that?
I said the first year, it was on everything. It was also on Game Pass, which was hilariously weird.
But yeah, they're even less happy about it now, since they are now seemingly done with the idea of doing multi-platform shit. So
yeah.
Okay.
So yeah, I'm going to end this sports segment. On this note, both UConn men's and women's teams are in the Final Four, and I hope they both win the national championships and give a big old middle finger to the fucking WNBA ownership. That's all.
Okay. Let's hit a couple of these things that Fireminer has been patiently waiting for answers on.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Some of these are mostly someone's trying to translate Xenosaga 1 and 2 on the DS. Yeah, I'm kind of surprised that took as long as it did, but it's nice to see some movement on that.
It's like they got the first three chapters. I can't remember exactly how many chapters there are considering it's two games together, but
they've made substantial progress.
It's a text dense game. I can say that much. They actually they've got in this menu there's a side story section of the main menu where you can just read through stuff that happened in other they converted several minor dungeons and plot points to text based for just because it was not really essential to the main plot, but if you want to read through it you can. So yeah. I mean, Xenosaga 1 and 2 original were not necessarily text light, but the DS version is much denser than they were in many ways. So I am not surprised that it's taking a while for them to do this properly.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that it's taking a while, but I'm kind of surprised we hadn't seen movement on it until now.
I'm guessing they're just keeping quiet just because they know it's taking a while.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, the DS fan translation scene has existed for many years, and this is the first group that I've seen, like, say, we're going to do this.
which I'm used to seeing like five groups attempt that before something actually gets made.
Yeah.
But yeah. Then mentioning if you're going to play Star Force Legacy Collection, remember to buy a pair of vertical, buy a vertical Switch grip. Which leads me to the question of, does such a thing exist for Switch 2? And Google seems to say not yet. Hopefully one day.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's a question in the Discord list we have been directed to. Oh, that is the wrong Discord. I am looking in the wrong Discord. let's see. I have many Discords. Okay. Let's see. So there's a few points in here, not the least of which is going to be rough because I've not actually played through this myself. I have fucked around with Alex in training mode, but have not bothered doing the arcade mode.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like the idea that everything in a story has to lead to something. You need the delays. You need the quiet moments to showcase the characters and the settings. That said, what does Alex's arcade ending in SF6 mean, and should it become a recurring plot point? Yeah, I forgot to bother playing through that last week because I have had busy times. So... my apologies? We'll go with my apologies. Let me go look at the ending right the fuck now. Everyone else, talk amongst yourselves.
Oh, well, I don't like Alex, so not gonna buy him.
How dare you. Don't worry. You have the game on Steam, right?
Yeah.
Don't worry, I'll take care of that for you.
Care what?
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 Okay.
You can gift DLC on Steam, right?
Yeah. Well, no, because you have to buy everything with in-game points.
Oh god,
no,
damn you it. Can just buy fucking things through Steam.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Steam works.
Okay. Yeah, I just watched the ending. I think it's nice to see when fighting game characters have inner lives that are not fighting. It's kind of theoretically, it's built in the same. It's built the same way that like Ken's Street Fighter 3 ending is, where it's just like he comes back home and talks to his wife and then his kid punches him in the dick. Like, just, you know, some of these characters have things that they do other than fight. Like, some of these live to fight and some of these people fight to live. And we definitely see that. Alex is a pro wrestler, so this is just kind of his thing. The follow-up question, due to the controversial revelations, this is not strictly relevant. Alex is not did not marry his first cousin, but the question came up: is it true that first cousins can legally marry each other in Japan?
Yeah, oh. It's that the falls under the as long as various other laws are held to, then who really cares? Portion of Japanese law, so they never bothered to make it illegal. So.
Yeah, it's another one of those things, like, it's actually legal in large parts of the United States. Culture is mostly what keeps anyone from ever doing it, because it's just like, well, that's weird.
And same thing in Japan. It's like, I mean, yeah. I bothered to look into it just because he asked this question, and it's barely into the single digits of total marriages in the country, as in it should be less than 1%. And it's just, yeah. Most
yeah,
people
it can
wouldn't.
Happen because.
Yeah. I mean, most people wouldn't. It can happen. If it does happen, why do we care enough to say no, as long as, like, it's ensured that other things are okay?
No. Yeah. It's one of those things that, like, it's honestly probably legal a lot of places that you wouldn't think of, but you don't think to ban something unless people are actually doing it.
Yeah. And I'm also kind of wondering how many of the of the laws of that sort in the United States came out of the eugenics movement 100 years ago.
Probably a little bit of that, yeah.
Quite a bit, I'm sure. Also, it's actually, this reminded me of a completely different sort of conversation I had with a coworker several years ago who was from Kenya. And she was trying to describe how the clan, her tribe's clan system worked and how they determined who was legally capable of marrying another person. And it gets really complicated and goes well outside of what we would normally consider normal rules of consanguinity. But as a consequence, like, one of her cousins went to America to study at university and hooked up with a nice Kenyan girl who was also studying there, and things got serious and they were getting married, and he brought her home to meet his family, and somebody asked her some questions. It turns out her uncle, who lived on the other side of the lake, was a relative of somebody else in such a way that it turns out she was on the wrong side of the family to be able to marry the coworker's cousin.
Oh, Lord.
And so there was a quiet council of family elders getting together and deciding, you know what, first of all, they're like literally at most third cousins, maybe. The rules kind of suck in this case. And in any case, they're both planning on they're both planning on just staying in the United States for perpetuity anyway. We won't say a word. It's like,
it's one of those situations where, like, there are, like, when you get to the point of someone I've never met before, I'm not going to have strong opinions about it. If you find out that, like, there's some sort of, like, tie there. I forget what the exact number is for, like, what the exact number is for, like, most unrelated a human can feasibly be.
Yeah, it would be really stretched out there. All knows that even with as close as single first cousins, it's still something that has to happen repeatedly within a population before it really starts becoming a problem. But yeah, but for the most part, nobody wants to, nobody really cares to. I'm sure.
Okay, so we'll hit one last cursed element of this question before we jump to the one that's in the chat. The backlash to Alex is a repeat of the backlash to Fire Emblem Fates and the reveal about the two main leads' familial ties. With Fire Emblem, the hardcore fans were at least prepared given what happened to the marriage system and genealogy of the Holy War.
Yeah.
It makes me wonder, though, if more Japanese exclusive games from the 80s to early aughts got translated, how many would shock the general audience outside of Japan? I honestly don't think that many. This is a weird kind of plot point in Japan, too.
Yeah, I was also thinking of one of Platy's comments to this question in the podcast channel. Do not take a lot of relationships in Japanese manga to be representative of the whole. Because a lot of these situations are intentionally cherry-picked out of the most extreme 1% of just oddness for shock value as much as anything else.
Just to lure in, like, various parts of the audience.
And then also you have situations like, I think it was it Princess Maker? Where there was just so many different weird possible endings. And then when the game got announced for a remake like a year ago, a certain portion of the fan base was disappointed because they had removed the two most problematic endings. The two that really probably should not have been in there in the first place. It was kind of sad that people were in fact upset about that. Like, no. Aside from the fact that those were the two endings that you would never have gotten unless you were specifically angling for it, and what does that say about you as a gamer and a person?
You made a choice, buddy.
Yes. And if you are upset that those choices are gone now, no.
But yeah, okay. So this Brings us into, you look at the retcon Capcom did to Alex's SF3 story to justify his SF6 story. You look at how the Tekken team insists to keep the balancing philosophy that made Tekken 8 Season 2 broken to Season 3, see Ninja Gaiden 2 Black being what it is instead of what the fans want. Already asked about the gap between the developers' thinking and the fans being too big that it becomes a problem. But when the developers double down on it, do you think that it's because it's their pride or because it's easier to change as little as possible instead of ripping the wiring out of the wall? A lot of times, these, like, let's look at these on a point by point. Street Fighter 3 retconning for Street Fighter 6. The answer is that they don't give a shit about, like, Street Fighter stories and have freely retconned them in the past for little or no reason. This time they have a good reason, so they're going to do it. Tekken 8 Season 2 to Season 3. I'm given to understand Season 3 does roll back some of the most egregious things in Season 3. Or Season 2. But, like, it's one of those, like, we already made, like, so, some backstory. Tekken 8 Season 2 is an infamously terrible balance patch. It made essentially every, like, half the cast able to kill you off of two interactions.
Oh, wow.
And it's, like, absolutely one of the least popular eras I've ever seen a fighting game go through. This, I would describe as, like, there's a few problems, like these are downsides that have been introduced by the nature of fighting games becoming live service instead of a bunch of individual releases. So bad versions of fighting games used to just happen sometimes. SF4 Arcade Edition or Street Fighter 2 the new Super Street Fighter 2 the new Challengers are both less popular than both versions around them. Just to name some obvious examples, you would get things like Tekken 6, not as beloved as 5 or 7. These would just happen. And the turnaround play was to just replace it. Like you put out the next version that fixes all of those problems. That next version is granted a fairly significant budget because it needs to have, like, it's to sell it, you need to add new characters and you need to add new features. So it's treated like a new game. It has more budget internally, even if, you know, like it has, and it's not, you're not like live fire testing all of these. You don't have an immediate access to all of fan responses. Tekken 8, Season 2 to Season 3, one thing that should probably be noted as a big old asterisk is Tekken's director since Tekken 2 left.
Oh.
Like, let me make sure I'm saying his name right. Katsuhiro Harada, like, had been, God, he might even have been, like, a co-director on Tekken 1. He has been with that franchise for fucking ever. Okay, yeah, he takes on the director role with 3. So he'd been the director since 3, and he was, like, kind of the Tekken guy, at least through Tekken 7, but also, like, was still, like, executive producer on 8, like, obviously still a major player on it. And now he's gone. They've lost that. They don't really have the option to release a boxed new edition of Tekken. Like, it's become clear people just don't buy into those that often. Capcom does it every few years with Street Fighter, which currently has its own thing. But basically, if you try to do a huge rebalance all at once, you run the risk of just doing the same thing in the opposite direction. You're going to have to take away tools from people. People hate that. Like, there's just a lot of things. I think that ultimately, if you're in the, oh, we really fucked up situation that Tekken 8 is in post-season 2, you kind of have to balance it piecemeal in seasons 3 and 4. Like, you need to do some restructuring in season 3 and further restructuring in season 4. Because these kinds of turnaround plays, you can't expect it to all be fixed at once. you're rebuilding reputation. You're like slowly figuring out what needs to be done. You're figuring out your balancing philosophy. And in this case, you're probably also like figuring out who you're still taking orders from. But yeah, Tekken 8 has issues, and I don't blame anyone who's working on it for having, I don't blame anyone who's playing it for being pissed, but I don't blame anyone who's working on it for not wanting to immediately jump into, we need to make massive changes, because there's another thing at play here, which is fighting game fans when they don't know how to deal with something, especially like people who are okay at it, but not great, tend to respond by saying this thing sucks and needs to go away. And that's often extremely, like, if you just immediately jump to what the player base is like howling for blood on, you'll sometimes end up like nerfing a character who wasn't even that strong to begin with. People just didn't know how to deal with them yet. And that happens a lot. You know, as often as you'll get like a Leroy in Tekken 7, you'll get situations where it's like, I'm trying to think of, like, I was thinking about some ones that were kind of paper tigers like this, but they do happen. These situations where like a character comes out and they're thought to be really overpowered, and then people kind of figure out how to deal with their tools, and then they're not really meta defining, we'll put it that way. But yeah, and you know, we look at something like Ninja Gaiden 2 Black. Ninja Gaiden 2 Black is a game like definitely was done as part of a Ninja Gaiden revival initiative that seems to have been internal at Koei Tecmo. That's why we got Ragebound and 4 around the same time. Obviously, you know, with the amount of money that was actually assigned to that project, it's not like they could they weren't going to try to go back to the original Ninja Gaiden 2 source code, presuming they still have it, and try to port that forward. They had Sigma 2 working on every modern console work with that. That's just what made sense. Is that disappointing? I mean, obviously, but you know, it's what they actually had money for, and that's ultimately what these come down to a lot of the time. Let's see. I've already asked about the cap. Okay, yeah. But yeah, I don't think pride really enters into this that often. But I guess the other angle I'll attack this from is that like players don't know what they want either. Like, just to be clear, a lot of people, like everyone, can agree on like the current season of Tekken is bad, or like, you know, it's very easy for people to agree on what they don't like, and it's very hard for them to agree on what should replace it, for a multitude of reasons, both because, you know, we all agree this sucks is pretty easy, but what did we want in its place is pretty hard. But also just like, you know, your fans aren't game designers. They don't know how to fix these things. The most you can take away from fans is like, you have to extrapolate what they're mad at. You have to work backwards from that to try to disentangle, because a lot of the people who talk about media don't do a lot to disentangle it. And a lot of people who try to disentangle it are bad at it. Speaking as someone who is bad at disentangling media, you know, a lot of the things that people want are like, a lot of the things people say they want, they wouldn't even be that happy if they got. So you kind of have to, you have a confluence of circumstances that prevent people from, that prevent the, a confluence of circumstances that prevent them from just doing what fans say. Let's see. I haven't talked positively about a parody visual novel in the past, but you guys should probably take a look at the new Ultraman visual novel about dating Zetton. I do not know anything about that character. It looks like something only hardcore Ultra fans can make. Like, if you enter your name as Redman, Ultraman's cousin, but more brutal, it just ends with Zetton running away. That's surreal. I think the Tekken 8 Season 2 is that the new Season 2 characters, Sans and I, actually have unique playstyles and unique identity of their own, but the identity... There's no what the Tekken team can do from those new characters. They're also used to broken characters, even in old Tekken, except for the very top, like C. Fox. Each character has... Players want variety. Yeah, there's like probably at least... Okay, how many characters are in Tekken 8 at this stage? Let me look. I am looking at the full list of Tekken characters to get an idea of who all's in this shit. Okay, oh jeez. Leave me the fuck alone. Why did I bother looking at the official? Okay. But ultimately, let's see. So I'm looking at... Yeah, that's like 35 characters, I think, plus some of the new ones. That's a lot to make individual. It's a lot to make unique. And ultimately, I think, you know, I've seen like a million different complaints, which is what I'm kind of getting at here, is that everyone can agree they're not happy. But I have, like, the biggest ones I've seen are based on the people I follow. They're issues of balance. The game just isn't balanced very well. And that's evidently, like, some portion of this. Some of it is that characters don't feel unique. That, if, like, I don't know how Season 2 specifically created that, because I'm not intimately familiar with Tekken. But... you know, like, if that is something that Season 2 itself did, like, I would run into questions of, like, what new balance problems it would create to try to revert those changes. Like, unbalanced characters, like, unbalanced games are things that Tekken players are used to some extent, but that doesn't mean they love them. Like, I did not, let us not forget the period where Leroy was 7 of the top 8 in major tournaments for several months.
Yeah, like, that's not...
People were not happy during that period as much as they're more not happy now. Like, there's a lot of factors going into this, and I'm not going to pretend that they have a simple job in front of themselves. Let's see. Okay. There's news that a group of fans is trying to modify Yu Suzuki's Propeller Arena to make it playable. That game was canceled because of 9/11. There was another PS2 flight combat sim called Savage Skies that was originally meant to be an Ozzy Osbourne game, but Ozzy pulled out because of 9/11. I wonder how many other games were affected by the attacks. Quite a few. A lot of them in relatively minor ways, a few in relatively drastic ones. It was relatively known news at the time because a lot of companies like admitted that they were pushing things back and making minor content edits. Metal Gear Solid 2's ending was made significantly more confusing by not showing Arsenal Gear crashing through New York for obvious reasons. Grand Theft Auto 3 got some minor content edits for probably pretty unsurprising reasons. Wheels, did you fall asleep?
No, good. Good. How are you?
You were asleep, weren't you?
No.
Then why were you running into the wall in your video game?
I was seeing if the wall was breakable.
That doesn't sound right. No, okay, but yeah, like... So, yeah, like, at the time, there were a number of games that were edited in some minor way or just pushed back. I could actually probably fish out an old issue of the official U.S. PlayStation magazine that just had a list right after the attacks of, like, this game has been delayed for content reasons or just for sensitivity to the existence of the attack having happened. There's some weird ones. There was a Spider-Man game that came out that had to suddenly have its ending edited because... in its original ending, you were fighting Electro atop the Twin Towers.
Didn't they have to delay the Spider-Man movie itself?
I think it might have been, although I'm not sure completely. I remember that it ended up coming out in like May of 2002, but I don't remember if that was like if they actually delayed it.
Maybe they just.
There were edits to like the skyline in places for again obvious reasons. But yeah, like there were a lot of these, and they were generally pretty public about it. There was a game that had any hope of a US release, like completely canned. In Europe, it would end up coming out in late 2002 and being called Detonator. And I think in Japan, it's called something like Buire Baku. But it was a game about blowing up buildings. So that one got like any hope of a US release for that got summarily killed. But yeah, there was a pretty significant reaction, like in terms of like most of the most major games at that time would have at least some change to them. Wheels fell asleep again. Mm-hmm. But let's see.
I vaguely remember one of the episodes of Cowboy Bebop that wasn't originally released in the U.S. on the first run was because there was a blown up skyscraper.
Yeah, like there was a Mad Bomber sort of character running around in that.
Yeah. That was
and one they had of to the... take another one out of circulation because of the space shuttle destruction.
Yeah. And then there was on the earlier episodes where it was a guy, an immortal who was stuck in the body of an 8-year-old. And
yeah, I think they just didn't want to show a child getting shot between the eyes.
Oof.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, all these episodes were shown later. It's just on the original run on Toonami, they didn't.
Yeah, some of them were shown and then pulled. Like I said, Wild Horses, like the disaster with the Columbia had not happened yet. Mm-hmm. But yeah. Let's see. Let's see, moving on to the next one. There was a simple 2000 PS2 game called Ochimusha. Main character being a samurai in red armor. It was clearly an Onimusha spoof. Can you think of other blatant game parodies?
Yes, a few, but a lot of them were, from franchises that like the parody anyway. The Sergeant Frog RPG, the one that was made by Wolf Studio and is probably the best Tails game on the DS.
I will not accept heart slander, but it was significantly better than either of the prior Tails games.
Yeah. No, I mean, in terms of gameplay, it was also a bit better than Hearts for gameplay.
I don't believe you.
Yeah. But no, in the three continents of the game were separated by, like, stylistically separated. Like, one was, like, all ninjas all the time. The second one was pirates. Mm-hmm. And third one was a very blatant Dragon Quest ripoff.
Mm-hmm.
Where when you go to the main town and you talk to the innkeeper, he starts complaining about these idiot adventurers who kept coming in, and he specifically names all six character classes that start for Dragon Quest IX. So,
I do think...
I mean, the exact wording of them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But yeah, for any of the like the anime-adapted video games that were the source material is going to be making fun of stuff to begin with, you will find parodies. Pretty obvious ones at times.
Yeah, I think the one that I would say is like the most successful form of this is Momotaro Dentetsu, which was, which, you know, obviously like Hudson Soft made in 1988. And the previous year had made like a Dragon Quest style RPG called Momotaro Densetsu. So it's like, yeah, that's kind of them just doing a self parody, like the choice to, like, it's not like, obviously both are based off of, you know, an old legend, but at the same time, like, Densetsu is kind of specifically a takeoff of the thing that they had just done the previous year.
Especially since Densetsu would mean the legend of the railroad.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's become the bigger franchise.
Yeah, but by far the more important franchise. Although Momotaro Densetsu does still occasionally see, it did still occasionally see releases up through like the early 2010s. But yeah,
of the other one.
Yeah, like Momotaro Densetsu kept like gave them a reason to keep caring. Meanwhile, like the most recent Momotaro Densetsu came out last November.
Yep.
But yeah, I would describe that as like a company directly parodying itself. Konami did a few things where like it was kind of just like a direct self-parody, whether it be by name or by like literal gameplay. Like I'll never get over that one of the Proteus, like the Proteus games in general, obviously.
Yes.
It's in but the name. Also, I love that one of them is like they would rope in just other random Konami franchises to make jokes about. Jikyo Shabari Proteus Forever with Me, which is a play on the re-release title of Tokimeki Memorial being Forever with You. But yeah, like Parodius, like of course being parody Gradius, Gradius took it to an art form. Parodius, one of them is fucking like its subtitle is like From Myth to Laughter. Which is a play on, I think it's Gradius III's official subtitle is From Legend to Myth. And then there's like there's one that was like directly a parody of like the fact that shooters were already losing popularity in like 1992.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Yeah, Gokujo Parodius Kako no Eko o Mote Mete, which
aiming for the glory of past.
Yeah, like pursue the glory of the past is how it's often translated. But basically, like that title is directly a parody of the fact that like it's 1994 and we're already having to reckon with the fact that the heyday of the space shooter is behind us. But yeah, like ironically they're not the only ones that do this among that like set. Like Parodius's success produces a game called Star Parodier, which is a Parodius version style take on Hudson's Star Soldier franchise.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like companies, especially in the early days, companies could kind of get away with this because it was cheap. It's not expensive to make a video game. Excuse me, but yeah.
Or for the matter, I'm remembering Slime Mori Mori Dragon Quest was making fun of a lot of stuff in its source material.
Mm-hmm.
But that was just cute.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We've got a few Persona ones that we should hit. It's a given now that the protagonist to any Persona game is going to be an easygoing guy who doesn't act strongly out of his opinions. That's the type of person who can make friends with everyone, go along with social link hijinks. But has Persona done enough to show just as how each friend of the protagonist changed because of them? They too were changed by the relationship. I don't think there's a way to show that, at least without making the protagonist have a stronger inbuilt personality. And there's degrees of that. Like the Persona 3, 4, and 5 protagonists do have different underlying personalities based on their interactions. And the Persona 3 male and female protagonists also seem to have different ones, just based on what they're allowed to say. So, like, you can get a read from Persona 3 protagonists that they're kind of a standoffish and quiet person. Persona 4 is still relatively quiet. Like, all these people are going to be quiet by nature. They're silent protagonists, but, like, more of a take charge kind of person, which is why they're often associated with, like, which is why their alternate costumes usually associate them with, like, boncho looks. And then Persona 5 is a little more mischievous.
I was going to say angry would be a good description for
more
Persona
anger
5.
In 5, but there's also more mischief.
Which, I mean, the entire thing is Phantom Thief coded.
Yeah, thieves and pricksters and,
as in
are all
the
over
genre
Persona
of
5.
Fiction. Yeah.
So between the two, like given the circumstances, like, you know, being upset at being wronged and doing trickster things are kind of the two core things about their, like, about which their backstory and the nature of the game's themes make sense. So, but yeah, like, making, showing how they improve relatively limited, because especially with 4 and 5, we're also kind of built, they're kind of built with the idea that they're someone who shows other people the way. Like, that's kind of built into the narrative theme as well. 3 kind of attempts it, but kind of fumbles the bag. Like, theoretically, the idea is that all of these friendships are what allows the 3 protagonists to make the sacrifice at the end of Persona 3 that they do. But because of how inexpertly he's actually, like, presented and written, they don't really manage to make that come across very well.
Which is the main limit for a lot of these games, is the ability to write them, the character, properly.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, like, these are hard things to bring across, even when you're good at them.
Mm-hmm.
See. Related next question. I've asked how cynical and self-serving can the social link system be implied to be, looking back at Shin Megami Tensei 2 and the idea of creating the perfect man-god, and how SMT5 Vengeance handled Yoko. I'm thinking about how, for everything said about SMT characters being more like mouthpieces for ideologies, the setting of each SMT game makes it so the most extreme side of a person comes out. Is there a middle road between Persona Daily Life and SMT's apocalypse scenario? That's called being a normal RPG. Things more like in the Raido or Digital Devil Saga mold would produce that if they were to make them. But ultimately, I think that would make them back in the PS2 era, like, when it was easier to make a bazillion of these and sort of test them all out, that made some degree of sense. I think now there's actually probably a gap in the market to bring that kind of thing back, just because, like, we get plenty of we get a lot of Japanese RPGs, but we don't get, like, enough to really flood the market. Same with really any of the genres of this type. But, you know, I think there would be space in the market to bring back something with SMT's aesthetics, but a more traditional, like, overworld progression, that kind of thing. But I don't think there's much appetite at Atlas to produce it. But yeah, I think the middle ground you're looking for is a normal ass RPG. They've experimented with it in the past. While I wouldn't be super surprised to see them do it, like, I feel like Metaphor was kind of their attempt to do that. And it does it quite well, to its credit. Like, Metaphor is a very good implementation of something that's kind of is that middle ground.
There was also Tokyo Mirage Sessions.
Yeah, TMS is wild for its own reasons, because also everyone's trying to be an idol.
Right. So,
everyone's insane to begin with. but yeah. But yeah, like that, that would also be in kind of that middle ground. We're not full daily life. We're still kind of larger than life, but we're also not immediately worrying about the apocalypse. But yeah, like ultimately, the space for that, I think, the appetite to do that and the space for it has been kind of filled by metaphor. But maybe we'll see it one day. Let's see. Previously asked about why no Metroidvania has or will have the depth of Symphony of the Night. But that's horizontal scalability. Can we talk about scaling vertically? Which game do you think has that figured out? You're going to need to like describe better to me what you mean by vertical scaling. Like horizontal scaling, I assume that you're talking about like sheer depth of like one-off interactions and weird scenarios, like that kind of thing. But like you're going to have to give me a better idea of what you mean by vertical scaling. I booted up Mary Skelter on a whim, and as I play it, it got me thinking. A dungeon crawler is a dungeon crawler because everything, storytelling, and mechanics exists to serve the act of exploring and fighting in the dungeons. What new thing can you even add to that formula to make it fresh? I mean, we see that quite a bit, but like, you run into this issue of a lot of people will know True Scotsman, the genre, if you start adding in other things.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's a lot of things that, like, are fundamentally doing dungeon crawly things that no one would call a dungeon crawler. I saw a discussion among some friends on a Discord that was a particularly, like, surreal argument that, like, in terms of what it's actually doing, aside from the no leveling up, the old Resident Evil games are dungeon crawls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could argue that, certainly. Yeah.
But, yeah, like the, you know, the way you dress something up and the emphases you make are very important to genre distinctions as much as, like, the raw mechanical underneath numbers. But yeah, I think that, yeah, one of these things you run into is that, like, when you start adding more things, people stop thinking of them as dungeon crawlers. Because genre distinctions are messy.
Mm.
Ever been a game that started as a dungeon crawler, but because the developer added too many things unrelated to the dungeons, that it became not a dungeon crawler? Honestly, I would kind of describe any the Persona's past three kind of are that. Like the social, I made the argument back when we did the backtrack for P3 Reload that social links in the original P3 were kind of just like feel like they exist to give flavor to the core, like just go explore the dungeon.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately they kind of, like, they didn't quote-unquote take over the game, but they absolutely became much more the emphasis than I think might have originally been considered.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the original, like, things, a lot of the original mechanics around, like, reversing and breaking social links existed to kind of recreate some of the balancing act tension that was supposed to exist. And then, you know, that sort of goes away because, as it turns out, people just want to see the stories play out and they don't want to have to do, like, I have to keep spending time with this person on a regular basis or they will go into reverse.
I had forgotten that was even a thing.
Yeah, original Persona 3 on PS2. If you don't talk to someone, if you don't spend time with someone for like 2 weeks, they just go into reverse. And it's very easy for that to just sort of happen if you're just not paying enough attention. Because it was social management. Like it was Tokimemo social management gussing that sort of thing up. But like,
yeah, again, Tokimemo, the genre.
Yeah, like Tokimemo, as another example of this, like the underlying mechanics of Tokimeki Memorial are basically a strategy game. Like, it's all management and sim shit. Like, keeping tabs on, like, well, I don't want to build up too much of this, or I'll track the girl that I'm not going for. But I can't ignore this, or else I'll, like, you know, if I'm, like, I might miss, I might, you know, if I ignore this stat for too long, it'll cause, like, school problems. And if I, you know, if I don't, if even though I'm not wanting this girl, if I don't go on dates with her occasionally, she'll get mad. And then when she gets mad, like, pops a bomb in the schedule, that'll hurt my reputation with the girl I actually want to spend time with. And it might set off someone else's bomb. Like, all of these, like, this is a, like, weird simulation management game. It's just that it's gussied up like dating.
Right.
I was going to say, this is, like, one of the core differences between dating simulator and visual novel from the beginning, in fact.
Yeah, it's, as much as those are treated as synonyms in English, they are very different beasts in Japan.
I mean, they're definitely co-evolved genres. Like, they definitely took from each other a lot, but the entire point of the game is quite a bit different between them.
Yeah, like, much of the like, appeal of the romance visual novel was to peel off the kind of person who was playing these, like, dating simulators that were for the story, for the characters, but didn't want to do all of this complicated management bullshit.
Whereas in reverse, a lot of the dating simulators actually started gaining more plot in order to attract the visual novel fans back.
As it became clear that that there were people who were playing strictly for that plot, it became more important that you, like, build that plot to be that you needed to compete with other games that were all plot.
And that's why I said they're definitely co-evolved genres.
Mm-hmm.
They really did start out around the same time.
Interact with each other.
Yeah. But yeah, they started out around the same time in gaming generations, and they attract a lot of the same demographics, and they knock stuff off of each other all the time. So, I mean, it's kind of understandable why somebody might mistake one for the other, even though they're quite different. Because it's like, they kind of look the same from the outside.
Yeah.
Okay.
I one of the reasons I liked the, what was it? I played Dead or Alive Extreme 3. I like the fact that you had volleyball, you had rock climbing, you know what I mean? You didn't just have text and dating stuff. I liked all those mini games. You could go play blackjack in the casino. Yeah. And I just get really bored with just straight up visual novels or dating sims. You know, I want actual, like, game. I don't know. I want something more gamey. I don't know what word I'm looking for, but I think you guys know what I mean.
Yeah. Gamified.
Yeah. So.
Of course, my favorite story about dating sims still has to be the DS game Girlfriend and its notorious right protection.
Got that one.
Did you hear about that one?
Yeah, I did.
This was right in the middle of the R4 issue where DS games were really easy to just copy and put on a flash drive for DS.
Mm-hmm.
And so the developers of this game, literally called Girlfriend, it was a dating sim, had like a sum check that happened every time you saved. And if it detected that the game was pirated, then immediately after your first save, your intended girlfriend would dump you, refuse to have anything to do with you, and every other girl in the game would call you an idiot.
Wow.
She made you feel bad.
Don't pirate games, kids.
So apparently right after that game came out, there was a flood of messages on the usual suspect message boards going, "Why did my girlfriend just dump me?" And
and you just gave yourself away, didn't you?
I gave her flowers, I talked to her, nothing's happening.
Nice.
Yeah, this is right up there with Earthbound for my favorite story of the developers finding a way of poison pilling the pirates.
Yeah, actually,
some really surreal ones.
Yeah, actually, when I was in college and I first got into like emulation, I did play Super Metroid, and I don't know, maybe this was a coincidence, but I swear, like, the game crashed when I went through that final door, like, before you get into Torian and all that. So, like, it's basically, it's the last save point, and from there you can't go back, and then you go to, like, the next room and the game crashes. So I don't know if it was just a corrupt ROM or if somebody was fucking with me, but yeah.
It sounds more like a corrupt ROM.
Okay.
But with Earthbound, because I can't remember exactly why they did this, but it had, like, maybe there was the possibility that it was going to be on the, one of the disk systems originally, and then the disk system got canceled, and but they kept the code in, where if the game senses that it is a copy, that it doesn't find the proper chip on the hardware or whatever, it will play as normal. Nope. It will also, but normal being hard mode in this case, where everything is...
Right, it spawns more enemies, right? And then you just get overwhelmed at a certain point.
Oh, no, no, even better. If you can finally make it to Gygas at the very end, then the game deletes itself.
Oh, okay.
You get to the final boss, and the game crashes, and your save file is gone.
Wow.
If you manage to make it that far, because, like I said, it's like overwhelming you with enemies that are a lot stronger than they should be. Yes.
Okay, that's a couple more that are in this line, and then I'll probably die. okay. Strange Journey is the perfect example of the classic SMT formula. Devil Survivor finished what Majin Tensei set out to do, and Metaphor is what Last Bible could have become had it not died. I already asked you about the future prospects of Demikids and Raido Kuzumo High. Is there any other branch of SMT that Atlus can not only make a new game, but also make it better than what has come before? Is there a point for Persona Q3 or SMT dancing and whatever? I would love for an SMT dancing game to not be a shitty rhythm game. That's the dream. Like, there are so many good rhythm games. Make a good one.
Jack Brothers.
That's a rhythm game?
Return of Jack Brothers.
I mean, that's the one thing that they haven't brought back yet.
That's true.
I was actually going to say, like, there's probably room for something like Digital Devil Saga to come in.
I can't remember what made Digital Devil Saga different from some of the others in this other set, series.
It was a more traditional RPG. Okay. Like, that was their FF10 style game.
Okay.
I thought Soul Hackers 2 was kind of neat.
Yeah. The Devil Summoner games were supposed to be more noir and plot based.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see Devil Summoner come back, but not as a Raido game. Like, more like Devil Summoner 1. Yeah.
Which, I mean, technically the main character of Devil Summoner 1 was Raido's descendant.
Yeah, kind of. But I mean, like, in terms of tone and mood.
I mean, a modern noir instead of a 1930s noir.
Yeah. Devil Summoner 1 has, like, a fucking batshit plot.
But, I mean, it's Atlus from the 90s.
Yeah, no, I just love that, like, you just, like, get fucking murdered right near the beginning.
Yep, murdered, and then wake up in the body of a detective who is not you.
Yeah. That's fine. Yeah. Your body now.
Yep.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see a back to basics Devil Summoner or a a new take on a similar idea of like Digital Devil Saga, where it's like a more traditional RPG but with SMT style like world and aesthetics. And then, yeah, like I said, make a dancing game that doesn't suck shit, please.
whoa.
Let's see. Okay, just like Persona 6 won't come out until Atlus are sure they have a killer script in their hands, they stop making mainline SMT games until they have a script. It's not just good, but was also able to avoid the pitfall of only the neutral routes make sense and doesn't suck. I don't think that's an accident. Like, I think that would require them to fundamentally rethink how they want to do the series. I don't think that they're doing that by accident. I think they are doing that on purpose. Do I think that they would be well served in not doing that? Like you mentioned, for Apocalypse. I think that they would probably be well served to give that a bit of rest, but I do think that they consider that part of the identity of the series. Let's see. Isn't it about time someone tried to remaster SMT9 or the mobile spinoffs like Majin Tensei Blind Thinker? That's getting obscure. I think that you won't see much call to remaster those because, like, especially 9, because who the fuck played it? Like,
is that the Xbox one?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the Japan-only original Xbox game. I will once again point
and
out
it's not Xbox, it's not numeral 9, it's actually literally
nine
named Xbox. Oh, sorry. Nine. N-I-N-E.
Yeah, because of the 9 alignments. SMT9 is one of those things that, like, I will point out the degree of unsuccess here for those who do not recall. The original Xbox never sold through its initial shipment in Japan. Like, that is the level of failure we are talking about when we discuss any Japan-only Xbox game.
Wow. The one Xbox exclusive Tales game to come out caused the Xbox to, like, triple its sales. Lifetime sales. Just for that game.
Yeah, that's Vesperia, and that's still a 360 game.
Yep.
Okay. Oh, that one didn't get remastered?
No, Vesperia has been remastered.
Oh, okay.
But for like, it didn't come out on PS3 for years after that.
Okay, gotcha.
But yeah, SMT9, like, I think one of those situations where, like, what I've been able to determine, like, a remaster probably wouldn't do, like, you would need to fully remake it, and there's just no appetite for that. And ultimately, like, the SMT9 that came out wasn't even really the game they were intending to make. It was the offline component of a bigger online game that they just fucking canceled because, Jesus Christ, why throw good money after bad? I don't think we're ever going to see that come back. Same with these mobile games. Like, tons of games will have these, like, mobile side games, and very few of them ever come back because they're kind of just not much to them. Like, I could tell you about the 3 or 4 different Persona 3 mobile side games that we will probably never see again.
Oh, I played one of those.
Which one?
I was very surprised I was able to manage 3D modeling, like, Antlus on my really old cell phone. Didn't do it very well, but it managed. I'm like, oh, wow.
They sure were 3D models. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's 3 or 4 of those, and, like, again, most of them will probably never see the light of day again, because it's just like, well, like, a lot of these were basically promotional. Like, they existed to be like, hey, look at the thing we actually want you to purchase and play. Which is why a lot of them never come back, for the same reason that, like, a lot of companies are not terribly... a lot of Western companies would not be terribly interested in bringing back the Flash games they used to promote AAA games from 2008. Which isn't to say none of them were interesting, it's just that this is sort of how a lot of them were sort of treated. Like, they were essentially promotional tie-ins for other games, and thus are not treated as being of the same value as the games they were meant to promote. I want to close out with one of the Discord questions, because one of these questions, digging back into when we were talking about parody games, there was apparently a question about Momotaro Dentetsu, so we'll do a quick run through that before my headache kills me. If I can see this. Mm-hmm. I don't see one of Albumo Tata Dentatsu. That's a bit of a shame. So I'll just pull something else from the question list here before I'll look at what's on the, since we're time limited here in terms of what's going to be on here, and I don't want to make him have to repost these. We'll do a quick one from this. Someone who worked on Act Razor 1 and 2 as a freelance artist hired by Quintet recently tweeted that NXT America explicitly asked them to remove the city building stuff in Act Razor 2 while also raising the difficulty. The city building, I get, but why the difficulty? To make it harder to beat in a rental. Like, what pushed NXT America or Working Design to do such a thing? Make it harder to complete in a rental. Was it so that kids wouldn't be able to finish the game in one sitting and thus had to rent the cartridge again? They don't want you to rent it at all. They want you to determine that it's too hard to finish on a rental and that you might as well buy it. They don't get shit from a rental other than the initial cost of the purchase price. They very
worth,
much want
worth noting that, I mean, in Japan, rentals were illegal.
Yeah, so that's why NX of America would have pushed for this.
Yeah.
The other thing would being that, like, I would suspect that the city building was left out because it was determined that, like, the conventional wisdom at the time would have been that American players would not have understood it and wouldn't have liked it. But yeah, like, the making it harder, it's rentals. It's always rentals. Okay. My throat is giving out, so tell me what I can read and not have to say.
So, yes. Well, good news. I am very, very close to actually finishing Princesses of the Pizza Parlor completely, main plot. Still need to type most of this, but episode 15 is almost done. And there are explosions. Lots of explosions.
Yeah.
Wow. Cool.
Yeah. But yeah, so that would make 15 main episodes, 5 side stories, and 1 paralogue that is novel length. So, yep, officially the length of War and Peace in 21 ebook installments.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Horrifying.
Yep, yep. It was, you know. Yep, so, yeah, so, again, if you enjoy tabletop role-playing games, if you like enjoying life vicariously through other people playing those, we have Princesses of the Pizza Parlor on Kindle and Kindle Unlimited by Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu. So, again, always thanks to my in-laws for letting me do that. And carrying on, we also have Japanese Folktales in Tanuki is a Teapot, Japanese folk stories all about animals in one way or another. Some very famous stories, some relatively unknown stories, a couple there. This is the only English version of them. I've got 2 more books at this point. Next up, Lit RPG Vainglorious Long as the Night, for a more Metroidvania styled approach to the genre. Speaking of things where people will not, no true Scotsman their way through a lot of things representative of the genre. You don't see a lot of games that are not somehow similar to, or don't see a lot of novels in this genre that are not somehow similar to Sword Art Online. At least in original concept. So this one is, like I said, Metroidvania and Universal Monster Universe B-movie style. Just, but that's probably the answer to why I did most of these books, is just because I could. What else? And then under the other pen name, Michael Spearwater, we have a travelogue romanticy called A Wager for Wanderlust, which is everything that I would not wish to have crossed demographically with the young adult fantasy section, but it's still fun to write. And coming up very soon, as in I should be getting my author's proof copy in the mail today, I hope, we have The Sin of Tantalus, which, let's see, how did, there was a thing on Blue Sky where they've been responding to, like, oh no, my story isn't political, it's just about, and then these incredibly political things. As a knock on Andy Weir's comments following the success of his most recent movie adaptation.
You mean Hail Mary?
Yeah, Project Hail Mary, where he was on a podcast and he was describing how it was successful because he had left out the woke politics.
Oh.
Yeah, and people have been ragging on him for that one. It's like, oh no, my near future dystopia isn't political. It's just about chronic illness, chronic illness, political apathy, and psychopathic cannibalism.
Okay. So,
not political at all, you know, it's just about the complete failure of the social structure to protect people who are vulnerable due to an infection. So,
that'd be silly.
Yes, I know. It's like I said, I wrote this thing in like 2018 and I did not expect it to be this more relevant now. Okay. Okay, yeah, that's about it for now. There will be more updates in the future. I'm working on more updates.
Future events such as these will affect you in the future.
Yes. Futuristically, yes.
And, let's see, where can we find you, Joe?
Yeah, you can still find me on RP Gamer's Twitch channel, which you're probably watching right now, if you're Fireminer or Moncappy or one of our other regular viewers. Yes, so twitch.tv/RPGamer. Tuesday and Thursday nights, I do live streams. Lately, I've been doing East 10 Proud Nordics, and that game's hard. So I've actually had to lower the difficulty for a couple of boss fights, but I'm just steadily making my way through it, you know, feeling like a pirate, just sailing the high seas, and just went to an island where they find a bunch of fruit, like lemons and stuff, and I'm like, they're not going to get scurvy now. So having fun with it, you know, it's great. And so it's Tuesday and Thursday nights. And then I do have a Blue Sky account, Instagram account, and I'm on YouTube as well. If you look under Smokin' Joe Gamer, got shit posts and old videos. I might be doing Metroidvania again. I mean, at least on my own channel. So just thinking about games I could play for that. And I did get a new controller. It is a Retrobit Sega Saturn Pro controller that has 6 buttons and 2 sticks. And I've been using that a lot. So I might do a review of that and just go over all the features. And that's gotten me back into like some Genesis and Saturn emulation. And also it works great for N64 emulation. So I don't know, just thinking about any content I could do if I feel the urge to do another YouTube video or revive my personal Twitch channel. We'll see. But yeah, but be sure to follow on Blue Sky and stuff if you want to see what I'm up to and read my dumb jokes and all that. So yeah, that's all I got for you.
And that leaves us with our whole thing, which is to say that you can find us at twitch.tv/rpgamer and twitch.tv/askwheels, usually around 8:30-ish Pacific, 11:30-ish Eastern on Mondays. When we record, if you ask us questions in the chat, in the chat section, Jesus, my brain's fried. If you ask us questions in the chat, then We will answer them as we did with Dear Friend Fireminer. You can also ask us in the RP Gamer Discord. If you go to rpgamer.com and go to the community tab, you can get an invite to that Discord. The podcast section of the Discord is always a good place to ask us questions. You can also ask us questions in the comments under this very episode on rpgamer.com. Otherwise, oh boy, I'm tired. I think that about wraps it up for us.
Go to bed, Dave.
Go to bed. See you, Space
Cowboys. Tam joined us. All right, see ya.
That's Wild Tam.
This is Mole Man in the morning.
Oh, good
Mole Man.
What have you done?
Double balls.
It stinks.
You know what? He just left.
I need new sounds here.
I didn't
talk about what I've been playing, but that's okay.
No one did.
Yeah, I know.
Next week.
That's fine. All right. No, we're off next week.
Oh, the week after that.
Yes.
Okay.
I was writing about no show next week.
You seem mad.
Well, I will let you know what my schedule is going forward with this next school year.
Okay. So. Yes, do let us know.
Yeah.
As per the usual for you.